Ladies and gentlemen, I apologize that I can't speak Finnish or Swedish for that matter. And that's actually the first time in my life that I'm here. I arrived less than 24 hours ago, and I'm very, very excited to be here and to tell you some of the things I think I know. So maybe I should tell you a little bit about my own background. I love data, and I love people, and I love people and data. So I did my PhD at Stanford in America after I did my undergraduate in Germany, and I studied neural networks. We have a Kohonen here in Finland. There are people in America who do neural networks, and what they are about is they're about learning from data. So you see by training a neural network what patterns people behave would exhibit. And then you make predictions, and you can act on those predictions. The 90s, I was first a professor of computer science, and then a professor of information systems, where I applied those ideas from data to Wall Street. So I was consulting for Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, Morgan Stanley, all these firms, in order to help them understand what patterns there were in the behavior of traders. Because these financial data were among the most interesting data to be found in the world. And then the internet came along. So like everybody who knew how to turn on a computer, I also moved to California, back to Stanford, and started a company called Mood Logic, and the purpose of that company was, well, you're not surprised, to collect. And specifically what we collected data about music, meta about music. Because if you think about it, we don't really know very much about songs, but most of us love music and it's very close to our heart. So the idea was, if we can get people to tell us something about the songs they're listening, whether they make them happy, whether they make them relaxed, whether they make them excited, what the quality of the voice is. If we only get people to do this, then we would be able to have people discover music they didn't even know existed. So that was 1999. We sold the company a couple of years ago, and to my surprise, after only 2.5 years, we had 1 billion explicit ratings of songs. 1 billion. It's amazing. Why? Because people loved to tell us about music. People loved to describe songs. People loved to give feedback. So we didn't need to pay people. At the beginning, we thought we have to pay people, but it turns out if you pay people, you get the wrong people. You don't get those who love the songs and want to tell you about why they love them, but you get those who do it for, you know, $1 or something like that. So one thing when we talk about feedback marketing, what we'll do today, is we really have to think about the incentives we can give to people. And the ultimate incentive is that people have, well, better afterwards. So by rating certain songs, you give them access to the ratings of other people. And so they have to discover things and to learn something about themselves. Maybe they even get to know some people who have a very similar taste in music. But I wanted to briefly tell you what I did. So after I started Mood Logic, I then went to Amazon.com and I worked there as a scientist until 2004. So I worked closely with Jeff Bezos, where we thought a lot about what our customers are doing and how can we market to these customers. Now, Amazon sacked the marketing department in January, I think, of 2003. No traditional marketing department. I'm not sure whether it's a bad thing, but that's what we decided. However, Amazon is doing a lot in terms of marketing. Let me give you a call. You probably know the term customer lifetime value. It's an of how many euros I can get out of your pocket. But if you think about and you think about connection between people, there are other things which are more important than the money I can get out of your pocket. And some of us, it's the network we have. So we used to coin the term customer network value. So that means it's not important really how many books Amazon.com can sell to me. But for example, a course at Stanford this quarter called Data Mining and E-Business, I have 5 textbooks for that. If all of my 50 students buy those books, then Amazon sells 250 books, more than I will buy probably until the rest of my life. So the question is, can we engineer feedback? And I want to give you an introductory example. There's something called share the love. So let's say you buy a book at Amazon, and once you buy the book, Amazon asks you, do you have any friends? Maybe people who might be interested in the same book? Well, why should I tell you about my friends? If they buy the same book within a week, at least one of them, you get 10% credit. They also get a discount. And you know, Amazon sells a new book and maybe even has a new customer. So that's the idea behind customer network value, that you engineer something, in this case, that little feature, to find out who are the influencers, who are the people who have a very high network value. So the example here is that after a couple of days, there were people who had 5,000 friends. Wow. And then these people, and it turned out it was the authors of the books. They wrote a book and they wanted to give all of them 10% off. So they bought one copy, maybe returned it afterwards. And then all of their friends saw, oh, wow, his new book is out. Is there anything wrong with that? No. Amazon sells 5,000 books. So you see, the basic underlying assumption is that if you leverage communication in both ways, then you can soon learn so much more about it than if you don't do that. So what I want to start with here is, I want to start with the thought how marketing communication has shifted. In the olden days, you would think about, you know, glossy paper, which of course gets shipped to people's houses. In America, catalog which gets looked at for 14 seconds. And that was communication, brand communication. This was a push. You got very little feedback. Only feedback in the most broadest sense, like, you know, how many people overall do buy tickets for an airline, or how many people maybe buy peak performance jackets. But very, very broad feedback. But that was what communication was about. Then about 10 years ago, a term to being called one-to-one marketing. The idea was that if I only figure out what Pavlov wants, I will bombard him, I will target him, all these military terms, until he is going to buy that thing. It didn't work. One-to-one marketing didn't work. But the term one-to-one has a very different meaning now. Think about, let's say, airline as an example, or restaurant as an example, or buying a jacket as another example. You, of course, talk to your friends about your experiences when you eat, when you buy clothes. We all do. It's a social process. So that one marketing is no longer the company figuring out how to target segments, but it's about you being the jacket you bought, or having had a good experience, or maybe bad experience on the airplane, you becoming marketers for that company. We used to say, the medium is the message, Marshall McLuhan in the 60s. No more. The product is the message. Corporations now stand there pretty much naked. It's no longer the glossy paper, which is the communication. It's the one-to-one communication about other people, telling them about the experiences at the SAS check-in counter in Moscow. Or the lady, when I came here, said, why don't you take a bottle of champagne from me? So maybe you have a friend you can give it to, which was just a great experience. Would never happen at a US airline. So this is now how communication happens. No more central, but customer to customer, to see, or one to one. Now, what does that mean for you? What can you do? You can try to listen to those communications and do issue management. If you see that certain things appear again and again, then maybe there actually are problems and you need to fix those problems. And don't just think about, you know, a focus group come to you, but the dialogue means that you don't just have a few select people come to you, or a few select people decide to write to customer relations. There's a statistic in the United States that out of, I think, 1,000 letters which were sent to United Airlines, only 27 ever got answered by customer relations. I mean, I don't want to waste my time in writing a letter if it probably ends up in the garbage. But people are already talking, so how can you listen to them? So I will talk to you here how people add themselves to, for instance, CRM lists, and I'll talk to you how you can listen to the blogs people have, to the people have. First lesson is you have to design things for feedback. To make the feedback in marketing an integral element of what your product is. Now, I want to give you a parallel here. The parallel is that of data. So I told you, I love data, and I love people, and I love people and data. So let's go back in history. Maybe 20 years ago, what data did a company really have? Whether it's your local corner store or your restaurant. Well, they had presumably data of what they bought and what they sold. But what they sold only in the aggregate, the inventory levels. Then, at the next stage, you had point of sales data. So to a cash register, and they ring up the marmalade, the bread, and the butter, and maybe some beer, maybe some vodka. So you knew what people buy together, but you had no history. Then people invented holograms. Why? Because the point is that, well, and now I get persistent history about it. Not really about a customer, because maybe some customers change their cards to make it difficult for the loyalty program. Some customers may just one card for the family, but just like the browser records the history of the computer, the card records the history of the card. Okay, so now we have persistent history, but only of the purchasing behavior. If you go to that store and think maybe I'll buy some cream cheese, and then you think, well, no, maybe I'm a little too fat anyways, and you instead, you know, buy some yogurt. They don't know that. They only know that you bought the yogurt. They don't know the process of creating and maintaining product-based awareness. Now, working with Metro Group, I'm doing a workshop with them on innovation in August. Metro Group is one of the world's largest retailers. Metro is trying out RFIDs as a bridge between the physical world and the digital world. So as you know, RFIDs are little chips. They cost a couple. They're about as big as a grain of salt, and you can embed them in basically any product, or your clothes, wherever. So now, let's do the same thing again with the cream cheese. If I go to the store and put the cream cheese in, but then take it out and go for the yogurt instead, they know that I was considering buying cream cheese and changed it to yogurt. And as I walk along, the dieting pills which they have suddenly start flashing at me, because I just self-selected, not because I was targeted, but I just self-selected in a group which, you know, worries a little bit about their weight. So now you live in a very different world. And as I check out, No, actually, I don't need to check out anymore. Because of who I am, they know everything to my car. I just walk through, it automatically gets debited from my account. I put it in my trunk, and I'm set. Drive home, go to the airport in San Francisco, check in. Dr. Weingen, okay, da, da, you know how it goes. And then I change to Copenhagen. And Copenhagen, yesterday, they knew who I was. How is this possible? Well, because you have a bunch of RFIDs on your body, like in the suit, like in your socks, in your shoes. So we know that the same guy who's in Cisco saying, Dr. Weigand, that's the same guy, or at least the same RFIDs who's just coming to the... Oh, I thought I was so scared that they really, without me ever having been there, to Copenhagen Airport. So you think that's funny? You think it's scary? I don't know. What do you think? It's engineering for feedback. It's engineering for feedback, extremely much so. Now, of course, it happened yesterday in Copenhagen. But that was day one at Amazon.com. So in the physical world, we don't have that yet. We could have it. We could put little RFID into catalogs, into mail. They really cost a fraction, a small fraction of what the mail costs. We could put it on the stamps and trace, where does it go? Do we lose letters? You know that Walmart saves more money every year than Amazon by having RFIDs in order to know where the stuff is. Walmart saves more money than all its revenues in a given year by knowing where stuff is. Pretty scary. So, but as I said, day one at Amazon, we knew where everybody clicks. Because Amazon has to know in order to serve the next page what you want to. So from e-business, we come from a world where things which in the field are maybe scary that somebody knows about the cream cheese story or about the Copenhagen Airport story, where somebody knows things from the very first day. So I want to tell you a little bit more about data. And I want to focus a little bit on marketing data because we want to talk about feedback marketing. So I've got aggregate data, I've talked about clicks. Now, the next data sources are attention data, interaction data, and location data. With our cream cheese, we live in the money economy. Money economy is order of 10 interactions a day. I buy my coffee, I buy my lunch, etc. Attention data is maybe 10 or 100 times more in a given day. Excuse me, where's the bathroom? That was an intentional exchange I had with the gentleman at the door. How do we make money off intention data? Any idea? Does any money off intention data? Well, Google's market capitalization of $150 billion, half as much as Microsoft, is due to one thing, intention data. Because I tell Google in that little search box what I'm interested in, and Google gives me some ads on the side which are fit to what my intention is at that moment. So the intention economy is, in terms of marketing, much more efficient than money economy. Why? Because I give Google feedback what I'm interested in. I tell Google, I want to know about a restaurant in Helsinki. That is intention data. Intention data means they flow from customer up to the company. But still, more powerful than intention data is attention. I mentioned already that the average catalog only gets used for 14 seconds. But if we do what those 14 seconds were focused on in the catalog, we could do such a better job in marketing than not knowing what the attention is set on. So once again, it's how can we hear attention feedback? So if we say we have 10 money exchanges, maybe 100 or even 1,000 interactions of intention, maybe it's 10,000 attention exchanges each day. You smiling, nodding at me, these are all attention exchanges. Thank you for giving me your attention. And if you think about movies, movies are about attention. If you think the Eurovision contest, it's about attention. So money follows attention. How can we in marketing to get the feedback of the intention of people? That's a big question. And whoever really solves that will, I think, have a company which is at least as big as the intention economy company called Google. The next step is then interaction. Not only that I attend to something, but what do I interact with? And who do I interact with? And the last piece of data is data. If you think about the Nokia N95, which has GPS in it, what a great device. Because it's more about me than probably, than surely anybody else. Who has a more close relationship to their mobile phone than to their partner? I don't want to see the hands. So when we collect all these feedback data in feedback marketing, the question is, who owns it? So here's my mobile. It knows where I am. Of course it knows where I am. I want to actually have a little interface which sends this GPS information up every few minutes to my website. So other people can also, as long as the mobile, know where I am. I think it's fun, as long as I own that information. I want to be able to turn it off. It also knows where I should be, because it has my calendar in it. It knows who my friends are, because those are the people which I answer them. It knows who the people are I don't want to hear about if I push the voicemail. It knows who I get emails, it knows who I respond to. So it knows my whole network of interactions. What a rich marketing device it is. What a rich feedback device it is. As we were talking last night over dinner, we were thinking, how can we, traditional post in CRM, customer relationship marketing, how can we build in feedback? And here's one example. Most phones, I think, which are sold these days, have a camera in them. And I counted, actually, I had 4 cameras last night at dinner. And if we could just give people something in response, them telling us what they attend to, like take a picture of that page they love in the catalog, or take a picture of that page that bugs them, or that ad, and just SMS them to somewhere with a MMS message. And if they see feedback that what they just said, I love that gadget or that jacket, then if they see that the world changes for them to the better, they will do this. And this way we get feedback from on a fine, fine granularity that we have never thought about before. So when we talk about communication, as we said before, communication has changed so big time. From the user now subscribing to things, the user really telling us what he's interested in, the adding, for instance, peak performance to the things he wants to know if they come out with a new cool jacket because he loves that. So one principle which we see here is that we move from targeting users in marketing, now comes an important word, self-selection. Users select themselves into a group. That is an important ingredient also for the next topic of my talk, what we call Web 2.0. For that, I have prepared some slides for you. And we have already talked about what kinds of feedback we can get in marketing. But the next slides, the next 20 minutes of my talk, actually are much deeper than that. They will show you how the pyramid, where the firm is on the top, turns upside down. where customers are on the top. Last year, there was a very good article in November about e-business, and that was in Business Week. Rob Hoff quoted me there saying, "Well, Andrea says we are going from e-business to me business. People used to write reviews at Amazon. Forget it. It's gone. Well, they did this. Now they write reviews on their blog." So we move from the sun is in the center, and you have people circling around the sun, like the earth circling around the sun. We have anti-Copernican revolution, where now people expect, well, the sun to circle around them. And then in December, Time magazine came out with, who is the person of the year? You. Yes, you. You control the information age of your world. What they didn't get quite right, and what I didn't get quite right, with from e-business to me business, is the communication aspect. Last week, I ran the Web 2.0 Congress. And the best talk was about music. And it was really interesting that Chris Pirkner made the point that if you sell your Apple shares now, it's probably the best time to do it. And if you buy Nokia, now is the best time to do it. Why? Last year, 5 times more MP3s were sold by Nokia than by Apple, which was absolutely shocking to me. So if you think about the sleeping giant that is in terms of MP3 players, then you really are amazed just how much as Apple gets for their little stupid iPods. Why do I say stupid? They don't talk to each other. It's 1% is in the intelligence of having a little hard drive or something you can plug your mobile phone in. But 99% so that actually you communicate your listening behavior. So not only did Nokia sell 5 times as many players than Apple, so the iPods, but those actually are smart players which can record your listening behavior and make recommendations based on the feedback you gave. So I would really bet that maybe in a few months, maybe it will take a year, with some of the labels now having made DRM, and removed DRM, that you can buy songs as MP3 without having to worry about where you play them anymore, the news from 2 weeks ago, that we are seeing shifts now in this discovery economy in music. And I think anybody who has an MP3 player that also talks to us, like a mobile phone, is in much better shape than just having a hard drive called iPod. But I wanted to talk about this. Web 1.0 versus Web 2.0. Web 1.0 is a read-only web, no feedback. We talk consumers, we talk about users. The term user is only used on the web and for drug users. It's not used anywhere. Web 2.0 is the read-write web. Ha! That's where the feedback channel appears. And I say tangent users, or producers, or prosumers, which is mixed between producer and consumer. I was at MySpace consulting earlier this year. They have 100 million users, 100 million people who participate. Now, what is the difference in business model? Web 1.0, the purpose was to have as high as possible barrier of exit. I remember when my dad tried to unsubscribe from AOL. What an ordeal. People didn't want to unsubscribe. Web 2.0 is about having as low as possible barrier of entry. So any Web 2.0 site, you have minimal work registered. In some cases, you don't even have to register. You only have to register if you want to be able to change what you created broke. So a lot of progress has been made in what we call interaction design. That we really think very deeply whether we absolutely need a piece of information and make the path so obvious for people to actually get to what they want. Not what we want, but what they want. Carefully measure which path they take by observing this on the web. One answer is that Web 1.0 was about pretest and validate. And even before the web, you know, shrink wrap software is a beautiful example where people needed to worry about what they send out because they sent out something which wasn't communicating, like an iPad. Whereas Web 2.0 is about launch and learn. Hey, try it out. Permanent beta. New features. Making it discoverable. Discoverability. Play with it and discover what's new. Very different mindset. In communication, this is the communication where the companies decide and control the communication on the web. All they can do is he can click on a certain link. That's it. Here. Bye-bye control. You don't control it anymore. People will write about it, whatever they write about it. And, you know, if somebody is just unhappy without the real reason, it doesn't really matter. Nobody will listen to it. If somebody was unhappy about, you know, a flight and everybody else is happy, it doesn't matter. It doesn't kill you at all. If most people are unhappy, you better worry about it. Discovery. Discovery was based on hyperlinks in Web 1.0. In Web 2.0, this is based on social relations. It's based on people you follow. So let me explain to you. There's a service, for example, called Delicious. And since we have internet access here, I'll show you as an example. If I go to Delicious, this is, as an example, people who tag vegan.com. So what does Delicious mean? If I go to Etela, go to Google, here we are, and this is the Etela page. Let's say I want to remember this page. Let me try to make it a bit bigger. Okay, if I want to remember the page, I can say tag that page. A window pops up by this company called Delicious. It belongs to Yahoo. And I can say tag Finland. And hit save and it's gone. Now, if I want to remember it, I'm doing it for myself. I can go back and say, what tags do I have? Here you go. This is the tag I just added, the Finland Post Corporation tag. So I tagged it with Finland. And yesterday, I tagged another page called the Digital Movement. And now what does discovery? Two other people also tagged that page. Now I can say, hey, discover what other things are those people interested in. And I can say, hey, let me, what is this person who put a tag onto that page? What is he interested in? And now you discover no longer because some company wants to discover something, no longer by following hyperlinks companies put in, but you discover based on the attention stream of some other person. I don't know this person. But, well, last time he or she tagged stuff was on April 23rd, and these are the things interested in. Say no to sameness, web of mass destruction. And how to be enabled and not enslaved by social media. So maybe that's interesting. So what we see is that marketing, which used to be controlled by those who own the brands, has shifted to no longer be the web, which is the read-only web, where you can only click in what companies tell you to click at, like the Etela web page, always be there. But now we can discover stuff based on the trajectories, based on the paths of other people. So I don't know this person. All I know is that he tagged one page that I also tagged. On some stage in life, his trajectory and my trajectory were parallel. And now I can see what he discovered afterwards. And maybe I'm not interested in his stuff. That's okay. Another example is that I can say, well, who actually tags Weigand.com? So I have a little website, not a good website, just a very primitive website. But if I look at this and I say, okay, let's figure out who tags my page. Then here are some 150, 140, 70 people who actually tagged my page. And some of them have comments here, the Amazon, and some could. Boya Dravy saw me in Copenhagen last year. Do I see, who is that? What else does he discover? And then you see what he discovers. What he discovers. So, yeah. People leave traces like breadcrumbs on the web. Primarily, they do it for themselves. The power comes through communication. That they're willing to share their breadcrumbs. The default is that you share your traces with the world. You can also do it privately. But the default is you. And then they can discover. And you have a virtuous cycle. That now they see they can discover. And I'm pretty sure that what you can discover here is at least as interesting as if you read some marketing materials. Now, I know you come from different backgrounds, but I think for most of you, it's worth thinking about. What should your response be? How will you be able to actually discover your products, your services, through this new web, this web tool? By the way, if you have any questions, there are many new concepts here. If you have any questions, do ask me. Because I know that for those of you who it's new, it's a very different worldview. It's sort of turning a pyramid upside down. Do interrupt me. Any question right now? Okay, this element I wanted to mention here is that advertising and marketing used to be push advertising, and it used to be supply driven. That company, let's say the Gap or Peak Performance, to use our example from before, has still a lot of pink shirt. They run ads for pink shirts. In this new world of discovery, it's demand driven. Do you have Zara in Finland? Yes. Yeah, okay. So there is an example of a company which produces very fast. They don't produce in China, actually. They produce in Morocco and around Spain. And if Madonna gives a concert in Barcelona, the first row, you see all these fashion designers scribble away. 10 days later, you can buy that dress she was wearing in the Zara stores in Spain. Last year, I talked to the CEO of Adidas, a German company which makes tennis shoes. And he told me that it's only 48 hours during the World Cup between deciding what shirts should be printed in Turkey and those shirts in the stores in Germany. Wow, you're talking about information logistics, talking about bridging physical and digital. That's really tightly how the feedback from customers influence the supply chain to the production of clothes. That's very interesting, I think, to think about how we have moved in the world from the supply driven, where some people are the arbitrators of taste and decided what you should be interested in, to, hey, in some way it emerges through peer production. People use the term user-generated content, and maybe it's not quite the right term. It depends, actually. If you take this, like on YouTube, it is mainly user redistributed content. You probably heard about these lawsuits like Viacom, I think, suing Google for $1 billion of copyright violation and stuff like that. So primarily these videos are somebody sees something funny and makes a copy and puts it up on YouTube. That's different for images, for photos, because Flickr is an example of a photo website where people put up pictures, and primarily these are pictures they took themselves. So an example of Flickr is my own very modest Flickr page where I put the pictures I take while I'm traveling up. And here, the lift on the shoulder is that 21 people saw that picture and 16 people saw that picture and so on. So not a big deal. The pictures people take are primarily pictures they take themselves. And what we see here is that we move, last but not least, again, through mobile phones with cameras, from an event-driven photography to attention-driven photography, or to an ambient photography. It used to be that some married and people take pictures. Now people have their cameras with them and they see something interesting, like me getting back to the US 2 weeks ago. And you know, you just take some pictures and you put them up and you share them with the rest of the world. Or maybe with the 20 people who watch pictures. So that's the difference here between user-generated content and it in the example of pictures and user redistributed content for videos. More important, I would say, than the content itself is the data about the content, the feedback about the content. So, example in music, I told you about mood logic. Example of tags, I showed you how people tag websites, but not just tagging websites. There's a company in New York called Socialite. What they do is, mobile phone, you go through the world. If you have GPS, then it knows where you are, and you can just write anything, like great coffee or weak coffee, and you post that to the world. And then anybody else who uses the free service, of course, advertising supported, when he is, let's say, in Finland, in Helsinki, in his room, he says, what tags do people leave here? And he sees that the coffee downstairs is good, better than the coffee owner, and he can decide on where he wants to go. So it's again bridging the physical and the digital. These are very small first steps, I think, of trying to make that bridge. And that bridge for me is a bridge which Intellia has to be in. Because you are in the physical business, but you're getting more and more digital. And how can you get the feedback in there? People giving feedback, people giving metadata for stuff. Yeah? Socialite. Thank you for asking. And I will just quickly show you the website. Socialite, funny spelling. Socialite. So you can explore, so we can look for coffee, and then we can see what's happening. It's giving feedback about physical objects. That's what it's doing. Oh, as the New York Times called post-its for passers-by. Okay, now comes a slide which gives you the framework which I see as an important framework. When companies, before we actually start really doing stuff, it's very important to understand what are their business metrics, what data do they collect. I've talked about data collection. Business metrics really depends on what your individual company. On the web, it could be conversion rates, or it could be page impressions, or, and you will see a bit in the next years, instead of just page impressions, which is passive, it could be something which is closer to measuring the somebody pays to your page. It could be tags. So now, the first thing is action comes the data analysis. The course I teach at Stanford this quarter is called Data Mining and EBIT. So what we talk about here is a lot of data collection. The next level is architectures of experimentation. Who of you knows what A-B testing means? Not so many people? Then let me actually give you an example of that. And I apologize that I, you know, have so many examples, but since I was there as chief scientist, it's sort of where I know the most, and I hope you don't mind. This is not advertising, I just want to show you some examples. Don't misunderstand me. So let's say somebody says here, add to shopping cart. And the reason that's Chinese is I figured in a few years the Chinese will be taking over the world anyways, so might as well be forever and do my slides anyways. So here, now what's Amazon going to show in response? Well, here's what I just created, my shopping cart with that CD I added to it. Now, Amazon makes more than 20% of its revenues through recommendations. And recommendations come in two flavors. They're so-called compliments, things you buy in addition to something else. So you buy your Nokia N95, and in addition to that, you buy maybe a Bluetooth headset. That's a compliment. The other thing is substitutes. You could buy the Nokia N95, or I don't know, is there any something else which you could buy instead of that if you want something which is as good? These would be substitutes. So I can talk about recommendations later. If you're interested in this, maybe in the question and answers. What I want to do right now is just to bring one point home. I want to bring it home by asking you a question. That blue thing, our shopping cart, which we created, should it be on the right-hand side or should it be on the left-hand side? Both hands. Who thinks it should be on the right-hand side? Okay, that's about half of the people. Who thinks it should be on the left-hand side? Okay, fewer than that. So how do we now decide? Because we have to build the website, either it's on the right or it's on the left. We can't just tell. How should we decide? Any ideas?
Users,
exactly. Normally, particularly when I teach this in China, people give you long arguments because, you know, people read from right, but then in Arab countries, people read from right to left and maybe better. The only way is you first figure out what are your objectives. And here as objectives, I mentioned before, conversion rate as a good example, or just simply how many items do you sell. So you agree on these objectives. And by the way, it's not hard to agree on objectives. It's much easier, as a matter of fact, to agree on objectives than it is on these questions like whether it should be on the left or the right. And then you randomly pick a customer. Let's say those customers who have an even customer ID, you show it on the left. And those customers who have an odd customer ID, you show it on the right. And then you measure. You measure those metrics, and it turns out that the majority of you actually were right. Your intuitions were good. Namely, the shopping cart on the right is about 1% better than if you have the shopping cart on the left. This, ladies and gentlemen, is the same. You have Amazon, Google, eBay, Yahoo. At any given point in time, hundreds of such experiments are running without any of you knowing that you are the guinea pigs taking part in those experiments. That was a little illustration of the second point I wanted to make, namely, architectures of experimentation. Throughout Amazon used, for instance, a search box. If you look at Amazon.com for blue pens, what you see is these sponsored links, Google Ads, AdSets. Think every day about a check of $500,000 every day arrived from Google. Because when people click on this ad, shopping.com, for instance, pays Google, let's say $1, Amazon gets half of that. So if 1 million clicks, $500,000. But you have to be very clear what your objectives are. Because how often do you have to show somebody that if you look for blue pants, maybe none of those really would, you know, really look all that well on me. So maybe you should go somewhere else instead of Amazon. So what is the long-term effect? The point I want to make is that these A-B tests, as they are called, version A, version B, the people see this, half of the people see that, in parallel. Those A-B tests are great for short-term effects, but you have to have lots of statistical knowledge to evaluate what the long-term effects are. Lots of examples I could give you of people make mistakes. Third is architecture of participation. And for that, I think I already gave you this of tagging. Here's another example from Amazon. How do we get, Finland is a big country, how do we get to bridge the physical and the digital? I gave you Socialite as an example. Here's something very simple, Yellow Pages. I'm not sure whether any of you is interested in Yellow Page business, but Yellow Pages, local search, local advertising, is a relevant business. In the US, it's about $80 billion local. So here we had cameras, which we put in cars, and we drove through 37 cities and took pictures, GPS. But now who should actually now decide on whether for this shop close to where I live in San Francisco, that picture is maybe, or maybe it's that picture here. Who should decide that? You can't pay people to go, you know, 100 million pictures. Because if you just pay 10 cents per picture, it's $10 million. Key idea is feedback. Somebody is interested in getting the picture right. Somebody there, maybe the shop owner. And if you allow people to participate, architecture of party, then somebody will fix it. And if you go to Amazon.com and actually look at how good the pictures have been, you really would be surprised what a workforce of 10 million people can do for you. Of course, how does Amazon make money with this? Bridging the physical and the digital. And here, you can click to call, and the same story as what I showed you by clicking before. If you click to call the business, I would demo it right now actually, but it's middle of the night in California, so nobody will answer the phone there. It's just, you know, hearing a phone ring, not exciting for you. When somebody answers, when Amazon makes money with this little feature. Nothing bad about it. People are looking for, you show them a picture of the store, and if they want to talk to the store, they can do it with a push of a button. Here's another example. Many of you probably have some kind of a website. How do you get for feedback? You put a little box at the bottom saying, hey, give us suggestions. So we capture the context you're in, and then you tell us something explicitly. For instance, this page takes too long to load. You can enter some text, and then you can send it off. And every day, there are about 1,000 such comments which are coming in. You could say 1,000 comments, you know, not much, but these are 1,000 things which are broken on your web page. And how many people pay in Q&A, quality assurance, if you want to pay them to look at all these pages, you couldn't afford. Getting the customers to, in this case, explicitly give you feedback if something is broken. So This were examples of architectures of participation. The simplest slide I have one. This is the old world. Some people deciding on meaning. For instance, Germany, my home country, it is some people in Mannheim who decide on how to write things, how the commas should be set. Or the Académie Française decides on how people should say things. That's the old world. This has turned upside down. It's now the millions, tens of millions of people who find things, who decide things, who create new language, who create new expressions, who create new content, who tag content, who provide metadata. It's not a music label which decides on who should buy that CD and how you place it in Tower Records in the physical stores, which unfortunately all the Tower Records go last month in America. But it is the users on MySpace. 60% of all new music comes from MySpace. That's a market of about $15 billion a year. That's how discovery works. And among those examples here, I have Delicious. I showed you the web pages. I have Flickr.com, where you can tag. And another of the many, many examples there is 43things.com. And that's where people actually tag their life goals. Fourth level is architecture of interaction. I just want to show you one example here. And that's a contact management software coming out of Germany called OpenBC or called Xing. I don't know, do you have that in Finland as well? You've heard about it, okay. There's another one in America called LinkedIn, similar thing. So people put up their contact data. Now what's the interesting thing about it is this page here allows me to see members who have recently visited my page. That's again feedback. And people don't even know that they're giving me feedback. Somebody comes to my page, clicks on it, and I can see who is stalking me. Isn't that interesting? Think about this in the phone book. The phone book doesn't know that you're looking somewhere. The catalog doesn't know that you're looking at that product. Maybe that you even put a little yellow post-it on it because you're wearing that phone or that jacket. But here, if you're the company, you is looking at you. That's just examples of that feedback, of interactions. Now, closest to my heart is actually the last point on this slide. How can we build architectures of collaboration? How can you collaborate with your customers? Why? Because I think community is very, very important. A couple of weeks ago, I was giving a talk to 500 journalists in Germany on, you know, the future of the press. And I was wondering, why actually do people read paper, or why do people read stuff on the web? And I think it's because people want to belong to a community. This need for belonging is a key driver. So you know, as you go to the bathroom and pee next to somebody, you have something to talk to them about. Did you read that in the paper? Yes. What do you think about it? Ultimately, people want to learn about themselves. Every journalist knows that you want to present stories so there's some relevance for themselves about it. But I think the web has created, much more than before, a need for belonging. So marketing, feedback marketing, has to capture that need. There are other needs. I made a little list here. There's a need, for instance, for positive feedback. That is great. Somebody gives you a little pat on the shoulder, like what you said, saw before. Feedback. So people look at their picture. There's the fame that if you put the movie of yourself on YouTube, that, well, potentially, you know, could look at and you could become famous. There's two boys in Guangzhou, the back dorm boys. Weiwei, the name of the other one, who have 18 million downloads by lip-syncing to the Backstreet Boys. They were very famous. I had a hard time actually getting to meet them and taking them to my class at Tsinghua because they were so busy right now. And the last point is that people do it for the reputation. eBay is an example of a simple reputation system that if you treat people well, then you can actually charge a higher price than if you have no reputation. So we said I should talk for 1 hour. It's 3 o'clock right now. Let me just summarize what I think was important. And while I summarize, I'd like to ask you to think about the questions you have. So this is the talk I gave about feedback marketing. And it's actually the first time I talked about feedback marketing. Because when I was thinking about what changed and what do the successful companies make different from the less successful companies, I think the relentless search for feedback from customers in all possible ways is maybe the key difference. This assumes they have a good product. If you don't have a good product, you are hosed. You can't do much about it. Because the days of just trying to pull wool over the customer's eyes and push it to them, those days are pretty much gone. Okay, so assuming they have a good product, how can you improve it? By getting feedback from customers. Now, not only from those who write to customer relations, not only from those customers who you invite to come to some focus group, only from those customers who fill out web surveys, but from every single customer you have. Depending on what business you're in, we have to figure out together what is it that you need to put down those pipes for feedback. I think one of the most important pipes, totally underused, but poised to be used, is the mobile phone. Because we talked about mobile phone is always with us. Mobile phone is the perfection between the physical and the digital world. Now, what becomes important is how can you incentivize the customer to give you that feedback? Because you know that if people are engaged in marketing, then they will buy your product, if think about it, that comes all down the road. How can you get them to this feedback? Well, it again depends. For instance, I've done the online strategy for Swiss International Airlines, and Christoph Franz, the CEO, he says, you know, I want to know that from the people. So he has a little program. He can type a question, and he pushes the button, and those people who are waiting in lounges around the world for a Swiss International Airlines flight to depart 2 hours before departure, they get that question on the mobile. And right away it says you have 1,000 frequent flyers. As if you answer the question, you get 1,000 points. So you reach people when they're in their mind about to board the flight, and they have time because, you know, the time spent is not that productive, as opposed to the wrong thing would be after they arrive. Nobody has time to actually then, you know, deal with CEOs of business and airlines. So that is an example of just polling people, getting to them. And United Airlines, for instance, prints on the tickets. Go to United Feedback or UALfeedback.com. So that is, I think, really, which are not, you know, not digital products. You sit with your butt on a big tube out of metal. That's about as far from a digital product as you can get. But you still think, how can you engineer that for feedback? Important understanding why people do things, trying to help them to belong to something in this world where everybody has multiple persona and multiple pseudonyms, but where people lack belonging. I think that's a deep driver you should think about your engineer, your product for feedback. So that's what I had prepared for feedback marketing. And now I would be more than happy to up the conversation to any questions you have. And I think Pavlos is going probably.
Yeah, I probably should come up with you so the IQ on this stage will lower a little. Okay, everybody, there is a gentleman in a blue shirt who would like to ask a question. I probably know his name. Mr.